tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
An Al-Shabaab intelligence chief is reported killed by a U.S. airstrike. Gunfire breaks out in Gambia's capital. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. The Somali government says Al-Shabaab's intelligence chief was killed in a U.S. airstrike near the town of Sakau. The statement issued by Somalia's National Intelligence and Security Agency today says Abdi Shakur Talil was killed along with two others in Monday's strike. It says he was traveling between Sakau and the village of Jawari when his vehicle was destroyed. Al-Shabaab is trying to overthrow the Somali government and turn the country into an Islamic state. Residents and diplomats have reported heavy gunfire in Gambia's capital. The attacks began early today in Banjul, but the situation appeared calm by midday. President Yahya Jammeh was not in the country, though there were conflicting reports about his location. There was no confirmation of a coup attempt and no immediate statements from the government. Soldiers were restricting movement in and out of the capital, and residents of the city told VOA by phone they were staying home and not going to work. The AFP News Service quotes a United Nations official as saying the World Food Program plans to resume food aid to refugees in Kenya. The WFP's acting country director for Kenya, Thomas Hansen, says the food needs of refugees in Dadaab and Katuma will be fully met beginning in January. He says the resumption of aid follows a successful appeal to overseas donors. Refugees in the camps have fled to Kenya from Somalia, South Sudan, and Sudan itself. This is VOA News. Faisal Mohammed Ali appeared in a Kenyan court today to request bail in his ivory smuggling trial. The AFP reports that Ali is suspected of being the ringleader of an ivory trafficking ring. In June, officials discovered tusks weighing more than 2 tons and equivalent to at least 114 poached elephants. Ali fled the country after the discovery but was arrested last week in Tanzania and extradited back to Kenya. Authorities fear that if he isn't held in jail, he will flee again. Quoting government officials, the AFP reports Burundian security forces and members of an unidentified group from the Democratic Republic of Congo fought today in the province of Cibitoke. They say that at least 8 attackers were killed in the violence. Witnesses say around 200 fighters armed with assault rifles and grenade launchers crossed into the country. Mozambique's Constitutional Court has confirmed the victory of Felipe Nyusi in October's presidential election. The Frelimo party candidate took 57% of the vote. Nyusi's nearest rival, Alfonso Daklama of the Renamo party, won 37%. Libyan lawmaker Abu Bakr Baira says no one was killed when a suicide car bomb went off near the entrance to a building where the nation's internationally recognized parliament is headquartered. Lawmakers were meeting in a nearby hall in Tobruk. AP says no one claimed responsibility for the bombing. A rival Islamist government meets in the capital, Tripoli, and there has been fighting in the country as the two governments vie for control. The AFP reports that a Libyan military spokesman says one of his jets shot down an Islamist helicopter today after Islamist forces attacked an oil terminal in the east of the country. Researchers believe that bats are the source of the current Ebola epidemic in West Africa. A new study points to a different species of bats than the ones implicated in earlier outbreaks. The first person to catch Ebola in the current outbreak was a 2-year-old boy who lived near a large colony of free-tailed insect-eating bats. Children often caught and played with the bats. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was detained today by police shortly after he joined protesters in defiance of his house arrest sentence. Earlier, the court had found the political activist guilty of defrauding a French cosmetics company of at least $500,000. The court sentenced the 38-year-old lawyer and blogger to a 3.5-year suspended prison sentence in the case, far lower than the 10 years sought by prosecutors. Navalny's brother Oleg was also convicted and received the same sentence but ordered to jail. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Residents told VOA by phone the gunfire started around 2 a.m. and continued for several hours. One man said at first he thought it was just the traditional holiday fireworks until the pounding got heavier.
That's Anne Look reporting from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar on the attempted coup in the Gambia. Details next. Also in the news, the Somali government says Al-Shabaab intelligence chief was killed in a U.S. airstrike near the town of Sako. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, government forces in the Gambia appeared to have fended off an overnight coup attempt. President Yahya Jammeh is out of the country. Security forces locked down the capital today and patrolled the streets. The government issued a short statement late in the day denying rumors of instability, but has given no official details about what happened. And look has the latest from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
Residents of Banjul spent Tuesday in their homes waiting.
We are still waiting for a statement or announcement on radio. We've not had anything yet.
State-run radio and television were silent Tuesday. Shops and offices were closed. Residents told VOA by phone the gunfire started around 2 a.m. and continued for several hours. One man said at first he thought it was just the traditional holiday fireworks, until the pounding got heavier. Clashes were reported at the presidential palace, called the State House, and at the Denton Bridge leading into the capital. Government troops at that bridge Tuesday restricted access in and out of the city. Online Gambian media based in the United States broke the news of the fighting.
Whatever many guys, they are on top of the game there.
They are on top of the
The details of what happened remain fuzzy. Some reports refer to it as a mutiny, while others say the assault was mounted by ex-Gambian military, returned from exile in the U.S. and Europe. President Yahya Jammeh came to power in a coup in 1994. His government is heavily criticized abroad for what Amnesty International called earlier this year, quote, iron-fisted repression and widespread human rights violations. Much of the independent Gambian press live in exile. Gambian journalist Sharif Bojang lives in Dakar. He says Tuesday's events would mark at least the fourth serious attempt to overthrow President Jammeh, though the government claims to, quote, foil plots with relative frequency.
Altogether, the ones that I know were real coups, three, and then we know at least altogether the ones that we believe and the ones that we think we are just, you know, used to terminate, you know, others that are perceived to be opponents of the state, altogether is a dozen coup attempts against Jammeh.
The United States ejected the Gambia from the African Growth and Opportunity Act trade program in December. The move came just weeks after the Gambia blocked UN human rights investigators from visiting a jail, and Mr. Jammeh signed a law sentencing convicted homosexuals to life imprisonment. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
The Somali government says Al-Shabaab's intelligence chief was killed in a U.S. airstrike near the town of Sako. A statement issued by Somalia's National Intelligence and Security Agency today says Abdi Shakur Talil was killed along with two others in yesterday's strike. The statement reports he was traveling between Sako and the village of Jawari when his vehicle was destroyed. The Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab is trying to overthrow the Somali government and turn the country into a conservative Islamic state. A U.S. spokesman said yesterday that officials do not believe there were any civilian casualties in the airstrike. In September, another U.S. airstrike in Somalia killed Al-Shabaab leader Ahmed Abdi Godane. Somali and African Union troops have had success in beating back the militants over the past year. The Libyan government has hired a U.S. company to battle fires at two oil tanks at the port of El Sidr. A government spokesman says they signed a $6 million agreement, but he did not identify the firm. He says the firefighters will arrive in a few days to help local firefighters contain the blaze. He expressed concern that other tanks may catch fire and cause crude oil to leak into the Mediterranean. A spokesperson for ConocoPhillips says they had yet to determine the extent of the damage to the oil storage facilities. ConocoPhillips is an owner of the company that operates the El Sidr tanks. The tanks caught fire when Libyan Dawn militants fired rockets at the oil facility. The Liberian Ministry of Health has opened a new 50-acre cemetery in the capital, Monrovia, to bury those people who have died of Ebola. Safer burials are expected to lower the rate of infection. Assistant Minister Tolbert Nyanswa says the burial ground located on Disco Hill will permit the dignified and safe burial by trained staff of both Muslims and Christians. Nyanswa says traditional burial customs can be practiced by family members, but the hazardous custom of washing the bodies of Ebola victims is prohibited. The World Health Organization says the number of people infected by Ebola in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea has passed 20,000, with more than 7,800 deaths so far. In related news, researchers from Berlin's Robert Koch Institute have identified a different species of bat as a possible cause of the Ebola epidemic. In the medical journal Ambo Molecular Medicine, the researchers report that children often caught and played with free-tailed insect-eating bats. Previous research suggested the fruit bat, a popular food source in many countries, was the source of the virus. The new research was conducted in a village in Guinea where a two-year-old boy was identified as the first victim of the 2014 outbreak. The children's exposure to these large colony of bats presented the possibility of massive exposure. Meanwhile, a health worker who flew from Sierra Leone to Glasgow, Scotland, on Sunday is now being treated for Ebola at the Royal Free Hospital in London. The hospital has not identified the woman who has more than a dozen years' experience in public health in Scotland. She reportedly volunteered for Save the Children charity in West Africa. She's the first person diagnosed in Britain with Ebola. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In the Gambia, government forces appear to have fended off an overnight coup attempt, and the Somali government said al-Shabaab's intelligence chief was killed in a U.S. airstrike near the town of Sako. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. 2014 was a tough year for many migrants. Thousands risked and often lost their lives trying to seek safe havens from conflict and oppression. The International Organization for Migration is one of the agencies dealing with problems facing migrants. It's calling on governments to provide shelter for those in need. Joe Millman is a spokesman for the IOM from Geneva. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the major migrant issues of 2014 and the prospects for 2015.
Well, it was a difficult year. We had quite a lot of what the United Nations refers to as level three emergencies, you know, Iraq, Syria, the Ebola crisis in West Africa. And, of course, we saw a surge of migrant fatalities as people attempt to get away from some of these same places, principally bound for Europe. Our research indicated that over 4,000 people died crossing the Mediterranean, and mostly in boats leaving the shores of Libya, Egypt, Turkey, places like that. And we expect this to continue because it's a really tough environment out there right now for people in trouble.
Now, when you look at this situation, I know the IOM has called on various nations to help out, and especially try to rescue those on the Mediterranean. What response are you getting?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I mean, just this last few days, we've seen rescues of over 2,000 people, which is quite extraordinary given the weather conditions right now. I mean, people don't usually cross the Mediterranean in such numbers in these boats this late in the year. But I think over the course of 48 hours, just Christmas and Christmas Eve, the Italian groups brought in more than 2,000 people. We heard this morning that Turkey rescued over 130 people. We've also seen fatalities. There have been 8 reported missing this morning off Turkey, 4 last week, and near Sicily. We do hear, by the way, that a baby was born to a migrant on Christmas Day. We're reminded that it's a time of compassion and a time of concern. People are still trying to find safety in this world, and even in these difficult weeks, they're still crossing the seas.
Now, when they do try to cross the Mediterranean, are they in their own boats or are they relying mostly on smugglers?
Well, it's smugglers, and the question is whether they're relying on them or not is something we've been grappling with all year. Some people do engage smugglers, depending on their conditions and their situation, to get from one point to another. Others are, we believe, kidnapped by criminal groups somewhere in Africa and held till a ransom is paid, and then they're forced into some of these boats. So at this point, it's not really a migrant engaging a smuggler. It's a kidnapped victim being coerced into getting on an extremely dangerous craft. And we know thousands, literally thousands, have died this way this year. And we don't think of this as anything but an atrocity. And we don't believe any migrant, regardless of his or her legal status, has signed away their rights to be treated like a human being and to be treated with dignity. And we certainly not to risk their lives in these kind of trips.
Can you tell me what ethnic groups are primarily involved in trying to cross the Mediterranean?
Well, the two largest groups that we know of from the statistics the Italian Ministry of Interior has shown us on the rescues are Syrians and Eritreans. There have been over 165,000 people that have been registered as having arrived safely, usually on crafts that rescue them in the middle of the sea. And of those 167,000 or so, just about half, about 80,000, are divided equally between Syrians and Eritreans. And the rest, the largest numbers, are sub-Saharan Africans of various states. Palestine began to show up this year. We see some Egyptians. Occasionally Asians trapped in Libya, guest workers who've been trapped in the civil war. But the two big ones are Syria and Eritrea, both countries that are in terrible shape right now. And we believe this is a reflection of the dire need that people experience when they make these trips. It's unfair to classify them as economic migrants just seeking work. I mean, obviously, the two largest countries that are sending these migrants are not places that enjoy any kind of stability or safety right now. So we think this indicates that they're mostly fleeing violence, not just seeking employment.
Looking ahead to 2015, do you have a priority list yet?
Well, no. I mean, we continue to hope that the world will see these migrants with compassion and realize that there is the capacity throughout the developed world to absorb certainly this number of migrants that we see crossing the Mediterranean and other sea lanes. I should mention that Horn of Africa into the Arabian Peninsula is extremely dangerous. 24 Ethiopian bodies were found this morning, indicating that traffic is continuing right to the end of the year. Bay of Bengal also become very dangerous for Bangladeshis and folks from Myanmar. We expect all those things to continue to be something to keep an eye on. We'd like to remind people that Lebanon and Jordan have both absorbed almost 1 million refugees each, and they're much smaller places and much poorer countries than the countries of Europe. So certainly if they can absorb 1 million refugees apiece, the countries of Europe can band together and handle the level of traffic we're seeing crossing the Mediterranean now. That's just going to be our message, and I expect it will continue right through the next year.
Does the IOM have any other recommendations for nations that might be able to rescue those on the sea?
Well, we'd like to see organizations, perhaps transnationals, perhaps intergovernmental, set up spots someplace in relative safety, someplace perhaps outside the country where people are fleeing, but near enough to those places that a migrant can get to them and begin a legal orderly process for migration by documenting a status, by registering members of a family, by explaining to the authorities where they may already have relatives living in safety, perhaps in Europe or North America. We think this could be done in many places, and there have been some pilot projects set up. I believe Agadez in Niger is a place where we're beginning to see an attempt to forestall migrants who may be tempted to make it all the way to Libya to register with potential host governments or organizations that would allow them an orderly, safe passage to Europe. There can be much more of this done, and I know that will be our message in 2015 as well. We'd like to point out that we don't think of migration as a catastrophe or an emergency or an invasion in some of the extreme ways people speak of it. We'd like to remind listeners that our human species more than quadrupled its population over the course of a century that's just ended. That's never happened before in human history. And so we have a demographic situation, a sociological event, you might say, that there are just billions of people who are common to all of our same family who live throughout the world. Many of them are far from the resources that they could access to become productive, healthy world citizens. And what migrants do is they correct the imbalance. They go where the jobs are if there is no jobs where there are. They go where the resources are if they're short of resources where they are. And so we'd like to see the world embrace this as kind of a family reunion, much more than a kind of an emergency or an invasion that we often hear about.
Joel Millman is a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa. The UN deadline for a DRC rebel group to demobilize is rapidly approaching. The Security Council had set January 2nd as the date for the FDLR to cease its operations or face military action. The organization, the ENAF Project, says the FDLR has been one of the most destructive groups in Congo's conflict. It says attacks on civilians have included rape, torture, and burning people alive. The group is reported to use revenue from illicit gold mining and the charcoal trade to buy arms and ammunition. The ENAP Project says there's little evidence the rebels are disarming. A new study finds South Africa's path to racial and social reconciliation following decades of apartheid has several unexpected twists and turns. In Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell spoke to the lead author of this year's report from the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation.
The Institute for Justice and Reconciliation says South Africans are more often blurring race lines when it comes to trusting their fellow man, 20 years after the end of the racist system of apartheid. The report finds trust between South Africans of different races has consistently risen in the past decade. That is illustrated by the discovery that Black South Africans trust their political leaders, who are usually also Black, less than ever. That sentiment is no doubt bolstered by a seemingly never-ending procession of high-level corruption scandals. But IJC project leader Kim Whale says not all the news is positive. And research shows that in 2013, South Africans are about 10% less likely to agree that apartheid was a crime against humanity than they were just a decade earlier. The 2002 treaty establishing the International Criminal Court classified apartheid a crime against humanity. That loss of awareness of a widely held truth, she says, should be a concern.
It's worrying because if we don't keep this memory alive, then we won't be tuned into addressing its legacy in the present, and unfortunately its legacy still really does remain with us.
She is referring to the wide economic disparities that still fall along race lines. The divisions are easy to see even to a casual observer in Johannesburg, the nation's economic hub. On one street corner in a trendy neighborhood filled with hip coffee shops, bookstores, restaurants, and patrons of all races, VOA News finds race is still a sensitive topic. Many passersby refuse to share their views on race. Others ask that we stick to their first names only. Leslie, a 23-year-old Black man, works on the streets sometimes as a car guard. The rest of the time, he says, he is unemployed. But he does not see his situation as a legacy of apartheid and does not really remember it. When asked about the nation's historical inequalities, he came up blank.
94. 99, I was in grade 1. So you see, my brain was not elder to remember some things that they've been past.
Animator Paul Meyer, who is 40 and has three adopted children of a different race, says he is trying to raise his children in a land of equality and opportunity. But he says reconciliation is not happening everywhere.
I think it's a mixed bag, and I think you'll get different answers depending on who you speak to. I think there's definitely movement in both directions.
Bila Molefe, a 41-year-old domestic worker, said she thinks part of the divisions are caused by the inability of the government to crack down on crime.
What's stopping us is that we didn't reconcile yet. And we can't forgive each other. And there is a lot of things that are happening now that makes us angry each and every day, like corruption and robbery and stealing, all those things.
The IJC report says the nation's poor, who are almost all black, have been largely excluded from racial integration. Even the simple opportunity to socialize with people of other races narrows as income levels decrease. Wales says South Africans need to tear down their walls. First, the psychological ones, and then maybe some actual ones that abound around homes and buildings as part of extensive security measures in a crime-laden country.
So building awareness is the first step, and then there's structural transformation that requires the fact that South Africa still often looks very similarly to how it used to look during apartheid is a problem, and we need to readdress the way our cities are structured so that the poor are excluded and the poor remain black. So there are real structural changes that are required, but then also changes in terms of how ordinary South Africans understand racism and the operation of racism in society.
But she says South Africa has come a long way in just 20 years, though it has a long way to go. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And in news from the U.S., President Barack Obama says he is able to focus on what he calls long-term projects in domestic and foreign affairs. President Obama spoke as he entered the final 2 years of his presidency. VOA's Victor Beatty has the story.
In remarks to the U.S. public media organization NPR broadcast on Monday, Mr. Obama says his executive actions in recent weeks on immigration and Cuba were the result of years of work. He says he had foreseen 2014 as a breakthrough year, and after 6 years in office and an improving economy, he finally had the opportunity to deal with some thorny issues.
But at the end of 2014, I could look back and say we are as well positioned today as we have been in quite some time economically, that American leadership is more needed around the world than ever before. And that is liberating in the sense that a lot of the work that we've done is now beginning to bear fruit. And it gives me an opportunity then to start focusing on some of the other hard challenges that I didn't always have the time or the capacity to get to earlier in my presidency.
Mr. Obama says he now wants to focus on long-term projects, such as making sure all Americans benefit from an improving economy. And on the international front,
even as we're managing ISIL and trying to roll them back and ultimately defeat them, even as we've been executing the drawdown in Afghanistan in a responsible way, the moves like the Cuba diplomatic initiative are ones that I want to make sure I continue to pursue, partly because, frankly, it's easier for a president to do at the end of his term than a new president coming in.
When asked if he envisions opening an embassy in Tehran as he restores diplomatic ties with Cuba, Mr. Obama says the two countries are different. He says after 50 years of the same policy, it was time for a change with a tiny country that does not pose a significant threat. He calls Iran a large, sophisticated country with a history of state sponsorship of terrorism that is hostile to Israel and trying to develop a nuclear weapon. He says improved relations with Tehran will hinge on a verifiable nuclear agreement. Over time, he says, sanctions could be removed, Iran could be reintegrated into the international community, and that would serve as the basis for improving relations. The United States has not had diplomatic relations with Iran since 1980, after Iranian activists seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took its staff hostage. The U.S. and five other nations have been negotiating for a peaceful civilian-Iranian nuclear program. Iran has long denied its program has a military purpose. Despite reaching an interim deal in November 2013, the two sides have failed to reach a comprehensive agreement and extended the talks into next year with a new deadline at the end of June. As for advancing democracy, human rights, good governance, and the rule of law, Mr. Obama points to Myanmar, also known as Burma, and Tunisia, where transformations appear to be underway. He says these are countries where the U.S. can be opportunistic and do everything it can to help. But when it comes to nation building in Libya, Syria, and Iraq, Mr. Obama refers to them as generational projects where the U.S. can help but cannot do it for them. As for Russia and its actions in Ukraine, the president says steady sanctions pressure is making the Russian economy sufficiently vulnerable and increasingly difficult to manage. Mr. Obama also says following costly conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, he wants to focus U.S. resources at home, rebuilding schools, roads, basic science, and research. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Africa News tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In the Gambia, government forces appear to have fended off an overnight coup attempt. And the United States has carried out an airstrike against what the Pentagon calls a senior Al-Shabaab leader in Somalia. Coming up, music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, five U.S. universities partnering with Ethiopian schools on research and development projects. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy New Year, Yahias.
Sonny, I understand you'll be taking a look at some of the African football highlights from 2014.
Yahias, joining us once again on The Voice of America from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Sporty seasonal greetings and Happy New Year, David.
Thank you, Sonny, and best wishes to all our listeners from Cairo to Cape Town, from Madagascar to the Cape Verde Islands, all over the continent.
David, as we look forward to 2015, let's first look back at 2014 and the year in African football. First, the highlights, David. In your opinion, what were some of the highlights?
Well, Sonny, I'm going to look at the competitions first. Let's look at the World Cup, which is the premier football competition. And we've got to salute Algeria and Nigeria, both reaching the last 16. We've had so many African competitors down the years, but reaching the last 16 is proving very problematic and very few countries actually make it. I know a lot of Nigerians were not really that happy with the performance of their team, the Super Eagles, in Brazil. But nevertheless, they made the last 16, and they put up a pretty good fight before losing 2-0 to France. Algeria, I suppose, were the most impressive of the African teams at the World Cup. Not only did they reach the last 16 for the first time in their history, but they really stretched the eventual champions, Germany. They took them to extra time before losing 2-1. And it was a little bit sad that soon afterwards, when the team had returned to a hero's welcome in Algiers, that their coach, the Bosnian Vahid Halilhodžić, he quit to take up a post with Trabzonspor in Turkey. But, Sonny, as we move on to the Nations Cup, the successor to Halilhodžić, Christian Gourcuff, a Frenchman, he's proved to be equally successful, and the Algerian Desert Foxes won 5 qualifiers in a row to cruise into the finals. It was an achievement no other country among the 28 in the final phase of qualifying was able to emulate. So a really good year for the Desert Foxes, and this is reflected in the African rankings, where Ivory Coast, they seem to own first place. They've been there for so long, for many, many years now. But come the middle of 2014, they were knocked off the top perch by Algeria, and now it's Algeria who are ranked number one in Africa. And I guess deservedly, Sonny, they are the favorites for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. If we switch from national teams to clubs, the Champions League was won, surprisingly, by Anton Satif of Algeria. They beat V Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo on away goals, 2-2 in Kinshasa, and then 1-1 in Blida. Two really exciting, good quality football matches, with Satif perhaps just deserving their success. And that was their second success in Africa's Premier Club competition, coming after they won what was then known as the African Champions Cup way back in 1988. So Satif's success just highlighting the strength of Algerian football, both at national and club level. The Confederation Cup went to Al Ahly of Egypt. Now, Al Ahly of Egypt are a side you normally associate with the Champions League. They've won that competition a record 8 times. But they were eliminated in 2014 in the final qualifying round by their namesakes, Al Ahly Benghazi from Libya. So what happened is Ahly dropped down to the Confederations Cup. They scraped past El Jadida of Morocco on the away goal rule in a playoff to make it to the group stage. And it was tough all the way. And in the final, it looked like the Egyptian dream of a first Confederation Cup victory was going to elude them as the match went into stoppage time with Seaway Sport of Ivory Coast hanging on 0-0 in Cairo, but the Ivorians were a 2-1 lead from the first leg. And then 6 minutes into stoppage time, a cross from Walid Suleiman, a superb header from Imad Matib, really one of the last, if not the last link with the great Al Ahly sides of the 2005 to 2008 years. His header flew into the net, 1-0 to Ahly on the night, 2-2 on aggregate, but Ahly took the title on the away goals rule. And I guess, Sonny, the fact that both Satif and Ahly won on the away goals rules stresses just how competitive club football in Africa has become at Champions League and Confederation Cup level. Another big high five would go out from me to Guinea. This is one of the countries worst affected by the Ebola epidemic. It's put a really dark cloud over the continent this year, and it has, of course, affected football like every other sphere of life. But Guinea refused to be bowed by it. They had 2 great wins at the end of their qualifying competition. Went to Lomé and hammered Togo by 4-1. They then hosted Uganda in their temporary home of Casablanca in Morocco and won by 2-0. So well done, the silly national of Guinea, for making it to the finals. And also well done to Yaya Toure, who's now very close to a record 4th consecutive African Footballer of the Year title. He certainly would get my vote. The Ivorian midfielder, he's an absolute colossus. And he's one of the main reasons why Manchester City are among the premier clubs in the English Premier League. It's now, Sonny, down to 3 candidates for the title. And the other 2 are the Gabon striker, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who plays for Borussia Dortmund in Germany, and the outstanding Nigeria goalkeeper, Vincent Enyema, who plays for Lille in France. But my vote, for what it's worth, would go to Yaya Toure. Some of the highlights of African football in 2014.
David, you mentioned North African clubs lifting the 2 major continental trophies, as well as the Desert Foxes from Algeria, ending the year as the number 1 ranked team in Africa. Does that in any way indicate a shift in power to North Africa when it comes to football?
Yeah, good point, Sonny. North Africa, they sort of lost their grip on power a little bit in recent years, but it looks like they've regained it. I mean, if you look at across the top of the continent, the Moroccan clubs, the Algerian clubs, the Tunisian clubs especially, and also the Egyptian clubs. Between them, Sonny, they've won far more trophies than any other region of the continent. West Africa would come second best. But if you look at West Africa, for example, this year, apart from Seaway Sport of Ivory Coast and the Confederation Cup, no real serious challengers there. Particularly disappointing were the Ghanaian and Nigerian sides. The thing about the North Africans, of course, at club level is they have a good funding and they're able to keep a lot of their players at home, whereas the stars, unfortunately, of West Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, to a large extent, they all head for Europe. Whereas you take, for example, Mohamed Abu Trika. There is a player who probably would have done very well in Europe, but he spent virtually his entire career playing for Al Ahly in Egypt. And somebody bemoaned to me the other day that there are no domestic stars in African football at the moment. I'm not sure I would agree with that. But all we do need, Sonny, we need a successor to Mohamed Abu Trika. He really was the sort of Africa-based superstar, and we don't have that just at the moment.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And we'll hear more soccer-licious comments from David later this week, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. During this festive holiday season, I encourage our VOA listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter, and do it during 2015, too. My Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports, and my Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. If you go to my Facebook page today, Tuesday, you'll see a portrait of yours truly that was painted by SS X-Man, a loyal Sunny Side of Sports listener in Auchi, Edo State, Nigeria. I was absolutely delighted and a bit stunned to receive the framed portrait on Monday at our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. X-Man included a letter with the portrait, which features yours truly in, yes, a Nigerian dashiki. And X-Man writes, "Dear Brother Sonny, I hereby express my appreciation for your sporty broadcasting service. I'm using this medium to congratulate you for a job well done throughout the world." The X-Man continues, "I must confess that we, the international listeners, are excited and thrilled for your daily broadcasts. Please ride on. I'm going to ride on throughout 2015, X-Man." To crown it all, the X-Man says, "The enclosed portrait is a token from my heart. Please accept it. I accept it with much gratitude, X-Man. I'm overwhelmed by the portrait. A Sunny Side of Sports shout out for SS X-Man in Auchi, Edo State, Nigeria. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahayas Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Coming up, 5 U.S. universities are partnering with Ethiopian schools on research and development projects. And next, we focus on Cameroon's gay community. But first, some music. Here is Mani Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba. Yoba yoba, mwana wa mama tuwe mmoja.
kusinzira yara dufite turabunza kuri batatu twibera mu mataba twiragiri nkazi wacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akabinajorwa umukurikiye akabinarumikwa na Mate kumu gabu da terwa kundi
Yubayo,
shenge
Yubayo,
haye
Yubayo, bamana wa mama tuwe mmoja
Yubayo,
bayo
Yubayo,
bayo,
bayo
Yubayo,
bayo,
bamana wa mama tuwe mmoja
Tangira kuryana byato nato bazo tubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera
Sogo kuru yaje kuducira umugani nako numufindo mbambaroga
afatinkone shatu arazivangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye
ati bana banje mumaze kuba bagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndewa
bana banje
Muri twe arazingira zimuna niyazikikiriza ubuheta
nanjye ture nizana mwereke araho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni zitubera ibamba ziratunanira
aye mama mvubire aye mama aye mama mvubire aye mama
Azifata, azikuraho wa murunga Arazikunyagura imwe ku yindi Dukora tugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye Nimuguma hamwe ntawuzabatera Nimuguma kuryana bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni
Ayi mama we 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 Yoba yoba, yoba yoba, mana wa mama tuwe mmoja.
Yoba yoba,
yoba yoba,
yoba yoba,
yoba yoba, mana wa mama tuwe mmoja.
Manny Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba. The U.S. is giving $15,000 grants to five U.S. universities that are partnering with Ethiopian schools on research and development projects. The initiative by the State Department and the Department of Education is designed to strengthen the skills of faculty and administrators in both countries. One grant awarded to the University of Maryland and Ethiopia's Debre Brahan University will be used to train Ethiopian women on how to grow crops as part of an effort to address food insecurity. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
Through classroom instruction and work on demonstration farms, the University of Maryland will provide training on how to grow food throughout the year with a goal of improving food security. University Technical Advisor Becky Ramsing says they hope to help women in Ethiopia who may have had limited access to training opportunities.
If you give the woman the resources, those resources will directly go to the family. And when women are given added income or able to raise more food, that directly relates to the children and the education and the nutrition of the child.
She says the goal is to train staff members at Debre Brahan University who will then teach women in useful techniques such as growing food in small spaces.
Some of these women don't have access to land. How can we do container gardening, vertical gardening, livestock like small poultry?
Sige Mariam Bashay is a program facilitator and dean at Debre Brahan. She says an overall goal is empowerment.
Empowering women is empowering the whole population or empowering the society.
Debre Brahan facilitator Hailu Tarifa says only men are traditionally taught farming in some parts of the country.
There is cultural differences. In Ethiopia, all the regions do not have the same culture. There are regions that women are not allowed to go for agricultural practices.
Sige Miriam Bashay hopes the women who are trained will in turn assist other women.
I hope in the near future, women in the project become a community educator.
The other U.S. university grant recipients are Brown, Bowling Green State, Ball State, and the University of North Texas Libraries. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
In Cameroon, homosexual acts are illegal and can carry a prison term for up to 5 years. Activists say the country has one of the highest rates of people in prison for being gay or even on the suspicion of being gay. Because of the alienation and personal risk of being an LGBT person, very few lawyers are willing to defend them. Michel Togé is one of the few lawyers who has decided to defend LGBT rights despite receiving death threats. Reporter Vincent McCourty asked him the prosecution rate for LGBT people in Cameroon.
One of the highest in Africa because, as you can imagine, Cameroon has as neighbors who share the same neighborhood with Gabon and Chad.
Yeah.
But homosexuality is not an offense in those countries. So in Cameroon, he has become famous. Cameroon has become very famous for his punishing homosexuality.
Now, what prompted you to take up these cases? You know, many people shy away from this. What made you feel like you need to take up the cases, risk your own life, and defend?
I will not say that because I'm open-minded, because, sure, I'm open-minded, and I understand that it is human rights. So many people don't see in homosexual rights, LGBT rights, human rights. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's like someone, anyway, those people are discriminated in Cameroon, and I feel as a duty to defend them, to represent them in court. Mm-hmm. You see?
Now, under the law of Cameroon, what can you do? How can you defend if the law states that this is a crime? Beyond having that law changed, how can you defend?
Yes, that's a very important question, because in Cameroon, the section 347 bis in our penal code says you're going to punish if you have been caught in act. But more people in Cameroon are in prison. Meanwhile, they have not been caught in act. So what we are doing is to show how the law is not really implemented as he has to be. So that is our duty, is to show that people are suspected of being homosexual. People are in prison because they are homosexuality. Meanwhile, they have not proved that they have been caught in act having sexual intercourse with the same gender.
Now, people like you have been threatened. You personally have had to relocate your family to the United States.
Sure.
Now, who threatens you? Is it government officials, or is this from private individuals who don't like what you do?
You know, Vincent, this is a very difficult question for me to answer, because I as you can imagine, I complained to the police, mm-hmm. but since 2 years today, there's no person who found as the one who was sending me death threats. So what I'm thinking is that the government has his part of this threat, because if there was not law punishing homosexuality, the other people would not have taken advantage to threat those who are suspected of
very
being homosexual.
Quickly, is this a new law, or this law has been there?
No, this is a very, very old law.
Okay. Yes, so mm-hmm. it exists
in 1972.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So unless repealed, mm-hmm. the situation will continue being the same. But I hope you stay safe, Mr. Togo. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Cameroonian lawyer Michel Togé. He was speaking to reporter Vincent McCourty. This is a... This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Nfunganye, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month, the world celebrates a natural resource that provides employment opportunities for 50 million people and food for billions, fisheries. World Fisheries Day, established in 1998 and celebrated annually on November 21st, highlights the importance of protecting the oceans and conserving marine life. President Barack Obama and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry have made environmental sustainability a priority of U.S. foreign policy. They recognize the linkages between fisheries, food security, economic welfare, and people's health worldwide. In Africa, where more than 200 million people eat fish as a main source of protein, sustainable fishing is critical. The economic potential is also great. The fisheries sector employs more than 12 million Africans, and fish is a leading export, with an annual value of nearly $3 billion. Fisheries provide government revenues through fishing agreements and license fees from foreign fishing fleets, which also drive economic activity in regional ports. Protecting marine environments isn't just about fish, it's about people. Despite the resource's great importance, its health and sustainability face increasing challenges. Illegal and unregulated fishing is a major environmental problem and a form of wildlife trafficking. West African fisheries, one of the most diverse and economically important in the world, lose over $1 billion a year this way. The United States stands side by side with our African partners in addressing fisheries issues. 11 African countries join nearly 90 nations at the Our Ocean Conference, hosted by Secretary Kerry in June, where sustainable fisheries were one of the key themes discussed. In September, Secretary Kerry joined Mozambican Foreign Minister Oldemiro Baloy and Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, José Graciano, in hosting a follow-on meeting on the margins of the UN General Assembly. We applaud Gabon's announcement this month to create a 46,000-square-kilometer network of marine-protected areas in its waters. This bold step shows Gabon's strong commitment to marine habitats, important species, and local livelihoods. African countries also were key voices in developing the Port State Measures Agreement, an international treaty that will make it harder for fishing vessels to land illegal catches at ports around the world, ensuring that countries profit from fish caught in their waters. From providing food to generating income to keeping marine ecosystems healthy, fish are an indispensable natural resource. The United States is committed to improving fisheries management, protecting the ocean, and safeguarding this marine bounty for generations to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.